Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We are coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. I'm Tina Quinn. In this edition, I'm joined by Australian author, journalist and pioneering feminist Anne Summers. First published in 1975, her groundbreaking work, Damned Whores and God's Police, is still in print today, and her career in journalism spans over 45 years. In 1979, Anne became the Australian Financial Review's first female political correspondent and was the editor of Good Weekend from 1993 to 1997. From 1983 to 1986, Anne ran the Office of the Status of Women during Bob Hawke's prime ministership and also served as an advisor to Prime Minister Paul Keating on women's issues. For many years, Anne has lived back and forth between Australia and the United States. She was the US editor for the Australian Financial Review from 1986 to 1987 and took over as editor-in-chief of Miss Magazine from 1987 to 1989. She joins me now from New York. Anne Summers, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Lovely to be with you, Tina.
It's been one hell of an election year. Now, what is the current feeling where you are in the States at the moment? Has the elation of Joe Biden's win lasted, or is it a much more subdued optimism?
Well, I guess, you know, it's a big country and a lot of people have different views. And as you know, the election is still not over in the sense that and not every state has certified the results, although we're nearly there. And it's, in 2 weeks' time, the Electoral College will meet and provide the final results. So in that sense, it will be over then. I think the sense that I'm getting from the people that I talk to is that there is tremendous relief that the Biden victory is so decisive. He didn't win by a little bit, he won by a lot. And although there's, you know, a ridiculous amount of media attention still directed at Trump, which I think is extremely damaging, I think the media should have a good hard look at itself about its role here. In fact, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have won at last count, and let's, you know, the votes still aren't all counted, amazingly enough. In New York, they still haven't, you know, finished counting. So already they have 81 million votes, and it's likely to grow a little bit more than that, and a margin of around 6.5 million. So this will be, you know, the largest gross vote that a president of the United States has ever won, ever. And the margin, I think, is going to be, if not the largest, certainly, you know, up there among the large ones. So the victory is decisive, and that's very important. I think the other thing that people are very, there's a little bit of discussion about the appointees as they're being, the nominees for jobs and appointees as they're being rolled out. There's discussion and there's, arguments about some of them, and there's, the normal argy-bargy about representation. But I think overall there's tremendous relief that government is back, that the team that Biden and Harris are putting together is a team of professionals, a team of experts. After the, you know, the clowns that we've had running things for the last 4 years, there's a sense of relief that it's possible to restore government. I think if there'd been a further 4 years of Trump, that may well be a question as to whether or not that could ever have happened again. But clearly, Biden not only has an extraordinarily talented team, which is obviously points to the fact that so many people were, you know, willing to work for him and have been willing to put their names up or to be willing to accept his drafting by him, and so that's made people feel very reassured. I think that the fact that there will be finally, oh, it's a pity we have to wait another 2 months, but finally, there will be competent leadership when it comes to managing the coronavirus, which, as you know, is completely out of control in this country, and the economy, which is also pretty much in free fall.
It seems extraordinary that you have to wait 2 months for that transition of power to take place. It's, you know, very different to what we have here in Australia. You've mentioned obviously the fantastic team that Biden is assembling. Now, I'd love to go through some of these appointments with you. The future is indeed looking very female. He has announced he will nominate Janet Yellen as his new Secretary of the Treasury, and she would be the first female to hold the position. First of all, how do you think this role is going? How important do you think this role is going to be during this administration, given the economic situation, as you've just referenced?
Oh, critical. I mean, absolutely critical. I mean, it used to be said that the four top jobs in the US government were, you know, Treasury, Justice, Defense, and State. So, diplomacy, defense, the administration of justice, and the management of the economy. That's, you know, possibly expanded now to include Homeland Security. But I mean, certainly the Treasury is one of, always has been, and now I think will assume even greater significance. And there's no doubt that the way in which Biden has, when he made the announcements in Delaware yesterday, and he gave a very interesting speech, and he started off by saying, when it comes to the economy, the economic ravaging that has occurred in the United States, help is on its way. Help is on the way, he said. And he, as he announced this team, and I thought it was very interesting that he framed the announcement of Janet Yellen and the rest of the team in terms of the way in which he expects them to respond to the coronavirus and the economy. And he's framing the coronavirus response as being as much an economic issue as it is a public health issue, and he'll be approaching it on those two fronts. So, you know, given the extreme severity of the coronavirus and the fact that it's getting, you know, we've had the head of the CDC today saying the next 3 months in America are going to be the worst in the country's history when it comes to public health, and he expects there'll be 450,000 deaths by the time that Biden is sworn in. So, I mean, the scale of the catastrophe that's facing Biden, can't be exaggerated. It is just worse and terrible. And so he is making it very clear that he expects this team to be, you know, they're not going to be there juggling, you know, monetary policy and having arcane discussions about, things on the margin. They are there to solve the big problems of the day and to do it very quickly.
Yeah, so it sounds to me like it will be a two-pronged approach, and that the two will go very much hand in hand together, which is incredibly important in this time.
Well, actually, it's a four-pronged approach. I mean, they're the two. He has four priorities. They're the top two. The other two are racial justice and climate change. So, I mean, that the four things really are integrated, and I expect the economic approach that Biden will want Yellen and her team to unfold will be one that takes into account those four major catastrophes, if you like, of American life at the moment, and none can be solved without the other.
Janet Yellen's resume is incredibly impressive. She was a Federal Reserve Board governor. She worked as a top economic advisor during the second term of the Clinton White House, and was nominated by President Obama as Federal Reserve Chair, the first female to hold this position as well. So her approach to the economy is strongly rooted in Keynesian economics. So based on her history, do you think her approach to handling the current recession will be one of interventionism?
Well, as I just said, I mean, the framework in which Biden is outlining is one in which the economy and the coronavirus are sort of integrally linked, and the approach that will be taken, you know, one has to be dealt with in terms of the other. So, I mean, that suggests intervention of one kind or another, but exactly what shape that's going to take. I think the other thing to remember about Biden is that he was vice president when Obama took over in 2009, at the time of the last great recession, or what in Australia we call the GFC, here they call it the Great Recession, where the unemployment then was actually worse than it is at the moment in the United States. And Biden, has very strong memories, I think, of how bad that situation was and what they had to do to turn it around. And, you know, the components of it were different, and what they were looking at there then were the banks and the auto industries, and it's different now. But the same kind of urgency is going to inform him, and the same kind of the need to take big, bold steps to shift whole sectors of the economy as required is something that I think that not only will he won't shy away from, but I mean, some of the team that he has put together are people who were there for that period in the Obama administration, quite a few of whom, you know, are on the record as saying that they felt that Obama was too timid and that they hope that Biden might be a little braver. And I wouldn't be at all surprised if that turns out to be the case.
Many feel that the incoming Biden administration will be a continuation of the Obama years, you know, a third Obama term, if you like. What do you feel about this? And do you think that means the culture wars of the past will return?
I don't think it's the return at all. I mean, I think people saying that are, you know, lazy and ill-informed, because, I mean, what just because Biden was vice president to Obama for all those years, and just because perhaps he's, you know, perhaps an unexpected president, no one really thought that he was had a chance of winning until, you know, the amazing event 6 months ago or 8 months ago in South Carolina turned everything around. I think a better way of looking at it is that, of course, Biden is drawing on a lot of the expertise and talent that worked for the Obama Biden administration. I mean, of course you would, because you know them, and those people are still around and relatively, you know, young and fresh and able to do the job. But I think you also should be looking at Biden's own life history, his own interests, and his own sort of stated political, you know, policy ambitions, and they are very different from Obama's. And I think that you're already seeing that in the way he frames the announcements that he's making every day, in the way he frames his approach to public policy. And I think that, you know, we'll probably be quite surprised by some of the things that he does.
Absolutely. I think the reason people sort of make that statement is because they see Biden as a moderate and Obama was a moderate. And I think they can, you know, they just sort of put two and two together. It doesn't always equal four. Biden has also chosen to appoint an all-female communications team, which is a historic first for the United States. He's also decided on Avril Haines as his Director of National Intelligence and Linda Thomas-Greenfield as UN Ambassador. What can you tell us about some of these appointments?
Well, I think I've spent a bit of time this afternoon just going through the appointments that have already been announced and just sort of looking at the breakdown of gender and people of colour. And it's a very, very interesting set of appointments, I think. I mean, he's the four areas that he's announced so far are the economy, the economic team, a six-person economic team, of whom four of the six are women and three of the six are people of colour, not necessarily women. I mean, one of them is and one of them isn't. When it comes to the national security team of five people, two of them are women and, again, another two are people of colour. Interesting, the White House team, which is, you know, his main sort of staffing, there are 24 people who have been announced so far as White House staff. The 17 of those are women, so, you know, a very, very big majority. And of those, seven of those are the communications team, and of those, of the seven, of course, as you've just said, all of whom are women, four of whom are people of colour, and at least one of them, I think possibly two of them, are lesbian. So the way in which the team is shaping up, and also if you look a bit broader at the transition team itself, which is 500 people, and 54% of that team, I think, are women, and 46% of them are people of colour. So if you look at the kind of way in which Biden has constructed the team of people to advise him and then the team of people that he is actually appointing, you can see that he is living up to the promise that he made during the campaign to give both women and people of colour and people of other, other areas of identification real representation within his government, not just token representation, but real representation. And we are seeing that with these women appointed to such incredibly high responsible positions. It's not just putting women in charge of, you know, housing and education, which are the traditional areas where women have traditionally served, but, you know, Janet Yellen, the women in the, on the near attendant for, you know, Office of Management and Budget, as you say, in the National Security team, Linda Thomas Greenfield and Avril Haines, and then the comms team, which is just quite a remarkable group. So I think what this is going to mean is that, you know, the face of the Biden, and of course, not forgetting Kamala Harris, who's the vice president, who is a woman, and a woman who's got both Asian ancestry and also African-American descendancy. So what this is all going to mean is that the face of the Biden-Harris administration is going to be a very, very different from what we've been accustomed to in any previous government. Even the Obama government did not have anything like this number of women, and certainly under Trump, well, you know, not even worth talking about. But excuse me, I think it's a very important statement that Biden is making, not just about you know, well, I think it is. Sorry, I think the statement that Biden is making with the shape of these appointments is that he understands that his government must look like America, as he likes to put it, in all its diversity. Not just gender, although but gender obviously is a very, very important part of that. And I think that's going to influence policy in ways that we haven't seen before. And the fact that all of the communications from both the White House, from the presidency and from the vice presidency are going to all be communicated by women, and in several cases by women of colour, African-American women. Kamala Harris's press secretary is a black woman, and the deputy press secretary for the White House is Karine Jean-Pierre. She's the deputy press secretary to the White House. So having these women with all their diversity being the ones who tell us what the government is doing and who are the face of the government and who answer the questions about the government, when you compare that with what we have at the moment and what we've had for the past 4 years, I think we're going to see not just a level of diversity, which is going to be very heartening, but also a level of competence and a level of perhaps, I don't want to use the word empathy because that's a bit overworked and a bit sort of meaningless, but just a level of comprehension, I think, of the complexity of the issues that government is dealing with and the fact that the responses are, you know, ones that live up to the depths of the problems.
Well, it seems like they've actually really listened to the social movements that have happened over the last number of years during the Trump administration, the Me Too movement and the Black Lives Matter protests earlier this year. So it's really exciting to see that level of diversity.
It's revolutionary. It's never happened before.
No.
And, you know, I'm very, very excited to see how it all works out.
One appointment that is proving quite controversial, and I know you just briefly mentioned her there, was Biden's pick for the Director of Office Management and Budget, Neera Tanden. She currently heads up a progressive US think tank, and she served in the Obama White House, but she is probably best known as a Clinton loyalist, and she's quite close with Hillary, and in particular, she worked on Hillary's 2000 Senate campaign, her 2008 primary campaign for the Democratic nomination, and her 2016 presidential election bid. So why is she attracting the ire of both the right and the left?
Well, because she dishes it out. I mean, she's very, very forceful. Presence on Twitter and has been for the last 4 years, and she serves it up. And I think it was reported this week she deleted 1,000 tweets the night before last, probably figuring out that, you know, all the abuse she's hurled at the senators over the years is not going to be helpful when she wants these guys to approve her her nomination. I mean, you know, the left don't like her, the Bernie people don't like her because she was very opposed to Bernie Sanders and for the way he treated Hillary back in 2016. And she's dealt it out to the GOP senators for very good reasons. So she's just somebody who's very outspoken, and the position that she's held, running the Center for American Progress, in fact required her to be very outspoken and to take these very strong positions. So I don't think she was doing anything that wasn't expected of her in the job. But nevertheless, it's made her a target. I mean, her appointment was one that really, really surprised a lot of people, including me, I must say. I think she's terrific, and I'm really glad she's been appointed. But it is kind of a, you know, I guess what Sir Humphrey would call a brave appointment or a courageous appointment.
Right.
She is so controversial. And, you know, there has been some unkind suggestions that maybe she has been put up as the sacrificial lamb, knowing that they won't get everybody through. They sort of throw somebody in there who's going to attract all the hostility, and that means everybody else will slip in behind her. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. We shall see. But there is certainly going to be a lot of sparks around that confirmation process, I would think.
How strange that an outspoken woman proves polarising to the greater public, as usual. Of course, the most groundbreaking and exciting appointment, as we've spoken about, by Biden was made months ago when he chose Kamala Harris as his running mate for vice president. Much was obviously made of the possibility that Hillary Clinton would have been the first female president. But the truth is, we've seen it depicted in film, and women like Geraldine Ferraro and Sarah Palin came close. But this will actually be the first time that the United States has even had a female VP. Do you think this is a tangible step towards seeing a female in the top job? Many are speculating that Biden will be a one-termer.
Well, there's a lot to unpack in that question.
Sorry, I didn't ramble a bit.
No. It's a key question. It's one we certainly want to talk about. I mean, I think the fact that Kamala Harris is the third woman vice president
on a
ticket, she's the first woman of colour, and she's the first woman to have been on a successful ticket. So she's way ahead of Geraldine Ferraro, who was the first, of course, and Sarah Palin, who was, you know, unfortunately not really a serious candidate.
No. Although Palin got a lot closer than Ferraro did, if you look at the sort of election results from 1904 and
08. I mean, I think you can say McCain did better. That Mondale did better than people don't vote for the vice president; they vote for the president. So I think you've got to be very careful about how you look at that. But the thing is, you know, she's there. She's there for the next 4 years, and that puts, you know, and she's quite young. She's, you know, she's early 50s from memory. So that would, you know, supposedly position her well to run at the top of the ticket in 2024. As you say, Biden may well not run for a second term. I mean, he would be, I think, 82 then. But, you know, whether or not he will run again is, you know, it's ridiculous to speculate at this time. But assuming he doesn't, I don't think you can assume that Kamala Harris would be able to run unopposed. I mean, there will be a whole generation of young Democrats, I mean, some of whom ran this time. Pete Buttigieg will be clearly up there trying to run, and there was quite a lot of speculation around the appointments as to whether or not, you know, what position Pete's possibly going to get in the administration, and whether it's one that would give him too much spotlight vis-a-vis Harris. So, you know, there are a lot of things to consider, but, I mean, that's all just politics and normal politics. You can't get away from the fact that for the next 4 years the spotlight is going to be on Kamala Harris in that unique position that she's serving. The thing that's very interesting is that when he offered her the job, Biden said to her he wanted her to be the last person in the room, which was the status he had with Obama, and that is that, you know, at the end of every important meeting, after everybody leaves, she stays behind and she's the last word in the president's ear before he makes his decision. So that gives her an extraordinary, not just a kind of an apprenticeship into doing the top job, which will be very, very valuable for her, but it's also a great sign of his confidence in her, her judgment and her abilities. So she's on a very steep learning curve, and you know, she's got a chance to star over the next 4 years, and it's going to be very, very interesting to watch how she plays it. But I think the fact that Biden so far, you know, is insisting that she's there for every announcement he makes, they're side by side the whole time. And tomorrow night they're giving the first ever joint interview on television. I think it's on CNN. So that'll be very interesting. So she's going to be, you know, have the political spotlight on her. And so long as she does a good job, I think that puts her in a very good, very strong position to run. The Republicans, of course, will run a woman next against her. So it could work very well be Kamala Harris versus Nikki Haley, which would be interesting to women of Indian background. But, you know, 4 years is a long way away and anything can happen. So we don't know yet.
Looking at her previous record, what can we expect in terms of leadership from Kamala Harris as vice president?
Well, she's the vice president. I mean, she's got to do what the president wants. So, her scope for unilateral action is very, very limited. It's going to be interesting to see what particular portfolios or areas of interest, you know, she either carves out for herself or you know, are given to her by Biden. Generally, you know, a vice president gets some areas that are their specialities, and I'm sure that will happen. So let's see what they are. You know, her background, of course, is in justice. She was a former attorney general of California, and before that she was a prosecutor in San Francisco. So, you know, that whole area of justice, particularly at the time when racial equality and Black Lives Matter and the whole issue about police brutality are such, you know, incredibly hot issues in the United States. I mean, her expertise and background there would be, you know, very, very valuable. So I'd imagine she'd be kind of front and centre in that area. I think, you know, the thing that's very interesting about her, she's very, very personable. She's, you know, she's terrific as a kind of retail politician. She's great out there with crowds and with people. People really like her, and you know, she could well be the kind of the younger female face of this administration, and that certainly won't hurt Biden. I mean, he's not going to be jealous of her or anything like that. And so she has a great potential, I think, to make an important contribution, provided she has the kind of policy areas to concentrate on, and I'm sure she will.
The Senate election results have obviously been quite disappointing for the Democrats. Do you think this suggests that the Biden administration will be spending a lot of time compromising in the coming years?
I don't think that's really the way to look at it. I think that the way in which the congressional politics have evolved in the past few years, and particularly in the past 4 years, and particularly in the Senate, and particularly under the leadership, if you want to use that word, of the majority leader Mitch McConnell, that the old days of, you know, horse trading and argy-bargy and compromise are long gone. So, you know, I mean, an LBJ would not survive in today's Senate because right. The rules are so different. They're not about reaching agreement. They're about absolute brutal blocking things. I mean, McConnell has not moved a single piece of legislation from Nancy Pelosi's house in 4 years. And, you know, there are important bills sitting on his desk that he absolutely refuses to deal with. So the issue of compromise, unfortunately, is sort of not one that's even on the political agenda anymore. And I know that Biden, you know, made a big deal during the campaign about the fact that he, you know, because of his long, you know, very long service in the Senate, would be able to work with the GOP, and he will be able to reach agreement with them. And I think even he already has been quite shocked by the level the lack of compromise, the lack of ability to want to even engage, let alone discuss anything. I mean, the fact that there's no COVID relief package on the table at the moment, likely to succeed, and that you have so many Americans unemployed, starving, literally, you know, without sufficient food, rent protection running out at the end of the year, and the fact that the Senate feels absolutely no responsibility to do anything about that is, you know, we've reached a new low in American politics that we've just never seen before. So I think the you know, unless a miracle happens and the two Senate seats in Georgia, the Georgia runoff elections, go to the Democrats, which is probably unlikely, but if that were to happen, and that would mean that they would then be able to have enough votes in the Senate to get legislation through. If that doesn't happen, I think it's going to be very, very difficult getting anything through. And so Biden is going to have to do what Trump did and what Obama did in his second term when he had a hostile Senate. He's going to have to rely on executive action.
Overall, how key do you think the role of women were in the outcome of this election, and in particular women of colour? There's been a lot of speculation that women like Stacey Abrams were really able to mobilise that part of the demographic in places like Georgia.
Well, again, that's a very big question, and we really know very, very little about it. I mean, there's an awful lot of discussion and an awful lot of speculation and not very much information that's based on
the demographics.
We don't know how people voted, and so everyone relies on exit polls, and the exit polls, I think, are questionable, at least, because they show a majority of white women, again, voting for Trump. And, you know, while that may have been the case, I find it very hard to reconcile that proposition with the other proposition that women in the suburbs, mainly white women, helped deliver victory to Trump, to the other proposition that young people turned out in enormous numbers, and, you know, a very large number of those young people are white women. So when you add up all these blocks of people who helped Biden to his victory, many of whom were white women, I don't know how you square that with the other proposition that the majority of white women voted for Trump. So laying that to one side, I think no one's arguing that the majority of black women, of course, the vast majority of black women voted for Biden. And, you know, women of colour, particularly African-American women, have been stalwarts of the Democratic Party for a very long time. And they are particularly fond of Biden because of his long history of relationships with some of those communities. So their votes are very important, and I think that has shown itself in the fact that when Biden committed to having a female vice president, there was tremendous pressure put on him to say that that woman must be a woman of colour, and he you know, he acceded to that, and in the end he only considered women of colour. And as it turned out, you know, there were about 10 different women that he could choose from. There was a terrific list of qualified women. And the same thing is happening now with some of his cabinet picks. There's tremendous pressure being put on him to choose people of colour, and they're going to be mostly men, I think, when it comes to Pentagon and some of the other big jobs. But no, I think the women of colour who supported him expect to be represented in the government, and I think on the results so far, and the nomination so far, looking at the White House economics team, the communications team, for instance, and looking at the vice president herself, women of colour are being very well represented in this administration.
Well, finally, how optimistic are you feeling about the future of America and the rippling effect that this administration change might have internationally, especially for close foreign allies like Australia?
Well, they're two very separate questions. I mean, I think the obviously the Biden administration has already moved to reinstate diplomacy and to reach out to other countries, particularly other democracies, including Australia. They've been, already, I think Jake Sullivan, who's the National Security Advisor, has been commenting today about this dust-up with China. So they're not even waiting until the inauguration before they're engaging with the allies. And I think that the allies, particularly in Europe and Australia and other close countries, close former friends of the United States, will be very relieved by that. But I think that is quite separate from the question about, you know, what's happening within the United States and whether or not the incredible divisions within that country can be resolved you know, we have 73 million people who voted for Trump, and many of whom are refusing to concede, along with the, you know, the fact that Trump himself is egging them on and urging them to, you know, to keep on fighting the last war. And this is, so I think the chance of repairing the brokenness, if you like, of America is going to be very, very tough. I mean, it's a very, very difficult prospect that Biden's going to be facing, and I'm not quite sure how he's going to go about addressing it. He obviously has to, and I'm sure he knows that. In some ways, I think you'll find the foreign policy much easier than domestic policy.
Ann Summers, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much for joining us in Fourth Estate.
Okay. I enjoyed it. Thanks, Tina.
That was author and journalist Ann Summers. And thanks for listening to Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is FourthEstateAU. Thanks to my producer, Anthony Dockrell. My name's Tina Quinn. Thanks for listening.